Before we start today's session, we will do a sound check with our speakers. Stephanie, can you go ahead and do a sound check for me, please?
Sure. This is Stephanie Berger.
And Mary, can you do a sound check for me, please?
Yes, this is Mary Adams.
Excellent. And Katie, can you go ahead and do a sound check, please?
Hi, everyone. This is Katie Wolf.
And last, Andrew, can you go ahead and do a sound check for us, please?
Yes. Hi, this is Andy Washburn.
Excellent. Mary, would you go ahead and introduce today's session, please?
Good afternoon. My name is Mary, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Ask the Department of Justice conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, please press the pound key. Thank you. Peter Berg with the Great Lakes ADA Center, you may begin your conference.
All right. Thank you very much, Mary. Welcome, everyone, to the June ADA Audio Conference session. The ADA Audio Conference series is a program of the ADA National Network. The National Network is funded by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Administration on Community Living, National Institute on Disability, Independent Living, and Rehabilitation Research. You can locate the regional ADA center that serves your state by visiting the National Network's website at adata.org. We are fortunate to have a collaborative of representatives from the Disability Rights Section within the Office of Civil Rights at the U.S. Department of Justice joining us today for an open Q&A session. Before we get to the Q&A portion of today's program, Stephanie Berger from the Department of Justice will provide a brief update on the Justice Department's initiatives and efforts that are ongoing. So our four speakers from the Department of Justice will include Mary Adams, who is a senior architect with the Department of Justice, Stephanie Berger, who is a senior attorney, Andrew Washburn, who is also an attorney with the Justice Department, and Katie Wolf, who is a special litigation attorney with the Department of Justice. So welcome, everyone. Sit back and get ready to hear some great information and some challenging questions for our representatives from the Department of Justice. So Stephanie, at this time, I will turn it over to you. Welcome.
Okay, great. Well, hi, everyone. It's our pleasure to join you today. So the Justice Department remains fully committed to the mission and goals of the Americans with Disabilities Act, and we are working hard every day using all available tools to realize the ADA's goals for people with disabilities across the nation. So let's dive right in and talk a little bit about some of the department's disability rights work over the past year, and then we'll get to answering your questions. So the first thing I wanted to highlight is one of our relatively new rules, which updated the Title III regulation to clarify a movie theater's obligation to provide appropriate auxiliary aids and services for people with disabilities. This rule took effect in December 2016, and the rule requires movie theaters to do three things. First, to have and maintain the equipment necessary to provide closed movie captioning and audio description when showing digital movies. Second, to provide notice to the public about the availability of these features. And third, to ensure that theater staff is available to assist patrons with the equipment. So although this movie rule has different deadlines depending on when a movie theater starts showing digital movies in its auditoriums, the most significant deadline just came to pass on June 2nd, 2018, so just 10 days ago. Most movie theaters that show digital movies need to have the required number of captioning and audio description devices by this date. This regulation establishes a nationally consistent standard and ensures that people with hearing and vision disabilities can fully enjoy watching movies with their families and friends in theaters across the country. So next, let's talk a little bit about enforcement. The Disability Rights Section exercises our authority to ensure compliance with the ADA through enforcement and litigation. Our staff are actively engaged in this effort, and through our U.S. Attorneys program, we have been delighted to work closely with U.S. attorneys across the country to enhance understanding of and compliance with the law. You are always welcome to review our settlements at www.ada.gov, and we want to work collaboratively with covered entities to reach voluntary compliance whenever it's possible. Our preference for voluntary compliance, however, does not mean that we are unwilling to enforce the ADA to ensure that people with disabilities are provided the equal opportunity and full participation that the ADA promises them. Our enforcement efforts range from matters involving physical accessibility, access to government services, effective communication, reasonable modifications of policies, practices, and procedures, employment, education, voting, transportation, access to healthcare, and many other issues. So here's an overview of some of our current top priority areas and the types of settlements that we've recently reached. The first area I will talk about is employment. So as you probably know, our authority to enforce the ADA applies to state or local government entities' employment practices, and then it's the EEOC that has jurisdiction over all other covered entities for employment matters. One of our recent settlements was in October 2017, when the department entered into a settlement agreement with the city of New Albany, Indiana. The case arose due to a breach of confidentiality for medical records gathered from a police officer in the course of the city's employment-related medical examination. So the city actually shared the employee's confidential medical information, including information on his disability, medication, and treatment, with the press. So in the settlement agreement...
This is Peter. I'm sorry. Can I just ask you to slow down just a bit for our captioner, please?
Sure.
Thank you.
So as I was saying, the violation here was that the city shared the employee's confidential medical information with the press. And so in the settlement agreement, the city agreed to revise its policies, practices, and procedures to ensure the confidentiality of employees' medical information, and to train all employees with access to confidential medical records, and also to provide the complainant with $100,000 in compensatory damages. So next, let's talk a little bit about voting and polling place accessibility. When it comes to polling place accessibility, there are numerous issues that we see, one being that people who use wheelchairs or other mobility aids, such as walkers, are unable to enter polling places because there's no ramp. We also see people who are blind or have low vision who have not been able to cast their vote independently and privately because the ballot is inaccessible. So we launched the ADA Voting Initiative in 2015 in partnership with U.S. Attorney's offices across the country to increase polling place accessibility. The ADA Voting Initiative covers all aspects of voting, from voter registration to casting ballots at neighborhood polling places. Since that time, we have surveyed approximately 1,500 polling places across the country. Our resolutions on these polling place accessibility issues can be found on our website, including recent settlement agreements with Monroe County, Illinois, Chicago, Palm Beach County, Florida, and Fauquier County in Virginia. I also want to mention our longstanding Project Civic Access. Through Project Civic Access, the department has comprehensively addressed accessibility issues in cities and towns across the nation. Project Civic Access work has resulted in over 220 resolutions in every state, including between 15 and 20 in the past few years. In January of this year, we reached our most recent Project Civic Access agreement with the City of Denver. The agreement requires Denver to remedy inaccessible features at courthouses, emergency shelters, libraries, parking lots, polling places, and parks. The city will also improve communication with people with hearing disabilities by contracting with sign language interpreters. Denver has also agreed to ensure that its emergency operations plan is accessible and to provide training to its employees on the ADA. Another big area of focus across not just the disability rights section, but the entire federal government, as I'm sure you've been hearing a lot about in the news lately, is the opioid crisis. As many of you are likely aware, the administration is focusing its efforts to stem the tide of opioid addiction that's gripping the nation. We at the Department of Justice recognize that we need to take a comprehensive approach to tackle this issue, and we often call this a three-pronged approach of prevention, enforcement, and treatment. So the Civil Rights Division specifically is focusing on that third prong of treatment by working to address discriminatory barriers to treatment. The ADA provides one of the many tools the department can use to expand access to treatment and recovery for individuals who have opioid use disorder, or OUD. So a lot of people don't realize that, for the most part, the ADA's coverage for people with disabilities extends to people who have substance use disorders, like OUD. Although the ADA generally does not protect individuals if they are currently engaging in the illegal use of drugs, and the covered entity takes action against them because of that illegal drug use, the ADA does protect individuals participating in medication-assisted treatment, or what's called MAT. These are individuals who are prescribed FDA-approved medications like methadone and Suboxone in conjunction with therapy and under the supervision of licensed healthcare professionals. As one example of our work in this area, the U.S. Attorney's Office in Boston recently reached a settlement with a skilled nursing facility to resolve allegations that the facility violated Title III by refusing to accept a patient because that patient was being treated for OUD. According to the complaint filed with the department, an individual seeking admission for treatment at this facility was denied because they were being treated with Suboxone. So under the terms of this agreement, the facility will adopt a non-discrimination policy, provide training on the ADA and OUD to personnel, and pay a civil penalty. On another topic, we all know that education has the power to open doors, but our efforts to ensure equal access to education are not just limited to higher education. Just last month, we reached a settlement agreement with Learning Care Group, the largest for-profit child care provider in North America. Learning Care Group operates over 900 child care centers nationwide. The settlement agreement resolves complaints that the company was discriminating against children with type 1 diabetes by failing to make reasonable modifications for them. Among other measures, the company agreed to pay $10,000 to each of the 8 aggrieved individuals, to train child care staff to assist with routine diabetes care tasks, and to evaluate requests for reasonable modifications on an individualized basis, using objective evidence and current medical standards, and not just acting on stereotypes about children with diabetes. The agreement helps ensure that all children can have equal access to child care centers. I also wanted to mention our Veterans Access Initiative. We recognize that many of our military veterans have acquired disabilities in the course of their service to our country. To ensure that veterans enjoy equal opportunities to participate in the activities of their choice, we are dedicating increased resources to this Veterans Access Initiative. In January, we settled a case brought by a veteran with post-traumatic stress disorder against the very memorably named When Pigs Fly barbecue pit, which is in upstate New York. The veteran wanted to go for an anticipatory July 4th holiday dinner on July 2nd because he wanted to avoid fireworks triggering his PTSD. But when he arrived at the restaurant with his family and his service dog, he was told that he could not sit inside the restaurant. He could only sit outside. So in a settlement, the restaurant agreed to allow service animals in the restaurant to prominently post that policy at the restaurant and on its website, and to train its staff on how to accommodate individuals who use service animals. Another important topic that's vital to ensuring the well-being of people with disabilities is access to medical services and facilities. Through the department's barrier-free healthcare initiative, which was established in 2012, U.S. attorneys' offices partner with us to ensure that people with disabilities are able to access healthcare. The barrier-free healthcare initiative addresses effective communication for people who are deaf or have hearing loss, physical access to medical care for people with mobility disabilities, and equal access to treatment for people who have HIV or AIDS, among other topics. I want to highlight just one of our recent agreements under the Barrier-Free Healthcare Initiative. We entered into a settlement agreement with Mountain States Health Alliance, a healthcare organization that operates 13 hospitals in Tennessee, Virginia, Kentucky, and North Carolina. The settlement agreement resolves allegations that the hospital failed to provide effective communication to 2 parents who were deaf, and their daughter was admitted to the hospital for a total of 115 days for cancer treatment. So that's quite some time to go without being able to effectively communicate with your daughter's care providers. As a result of the settlement, the organization has agreed to implement measures at all of its hospitals to protect the rights of patients and companions who are deaf or hard of hearing, including identifying services that can provide qualified sign language interpreters to each facility in a timely manner. The organization also agreed to pay a $50,000 civil penalty and reached a confidential agreement to compensate the family. So moving on from enforcement, I want to talk a little bit about mediation and technical assistance, which are some of our tools besides enforcement. One important tool we employ to help ensure ADA compliance is our mediation program, which has utilized professional mediators to help parties resolve thousands of complaints. Just this past year, mediation was offered in almost 650 different matters, and mediation was completed in 163 of those matters, with successful resolutions in 82% of those cases. The program, which is offered at no cost, has successfully resolved more than 7,000 cases since its inception. Another vital tool the Disability Rights Section uses to help advance ADA compliance is our technical assistance. In general, ADA.gov is a great source of information. I hope many of you are using it already, and I encourage you to look at it and to keep checking back because the site is updated often. You can also sign up for updates by email on the website, and you'll get email when new content has been added. In the last year, we've added a checklist that state and local governments can use to help them make polling places accessible to people with disabilities, as well as an updated publication on protection for people living with HIV and AIDS. Most recently, we added a link to a variety of federal government resources in order to help public entities ensure that their emergency preparedness, response, and management programs are accessible. Beyond our website, our ADA Technical Assistance Program provides free information and technical assistance directly to businesses, state and local governments, nonprofit service providers, people with disabilities, and, of course, the general public. The program includes a nationwide confidential toll-free information line staffed by a team that is solely devoted to answering the public's questions about how the ADA applies to their specific circumstances. And our ADA information line staff takes over 1,000 calls a week. So to conclude, before we start to take some of your questions, on behalf of the department, I want to thank you for giving us the opportunity to share some highlights from our work in the past year. And Peter, we're now happy to start answering some questions.
Hey, Peter, this is Katie.
Yes.
Before we go to questions, I just wanted to share just a couple of little stats that I thought your audience might be interested in and to encourage them to continue to use and recommend both our Speakers Bureau and our complaint intake process. So I thought you'd be interested in that in fiscal year to date, so that would be from October 1st of 2017 until today. Our intake unit has received over 11,500 complaints, and those come in through our online complaint process. Actually, that's where we get the majority of them, and also received by mail, fax, or email. In fiscal year 2017, we received over 15,000 complaints total. So keep those coming. And then the other stat that's interesting is our Speakers Bureau stat. One of the things that we do at the department is we love to go out and present when we're invited and asked when we can. And in fiscal year 2018, so far we've had staff do 20 events reaching well over 1,000 audience participants. So that's another way to spread the word, and we encourage those requests to keep coming. Now we'll turn it over to Peter. Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much, Katie, and thank you, Stephanie, for that update. Before I bring Mary in to give instructions for our phone participants, I was hoping you could address, Stephanie, you mentioned, or perhaps one of the other speakers can talk about the U.S. Attorney's program and how that works. Katie, you just talked about people, you know, filing complaints through a variety of means with the Justice Department. How does can individuals, you know, file directly with the U.S. Attorney's office, or are complaints received in D.C. by the Disability Rights Section and then forwarded on to the U.S. Attorney's Office?
Sure. This is Katie. So we have a very, very robust U.S. Attorney program, we call it. So we coordinate directly with I think we're up to maybe 90 offices participating across the country. And these offices are on the ground. They know their communities. And I have to say, the attorneys there really, really feel privileged to do the ADA work. This is, you know, their dockets may be largely defensive in posture, where they're defending the United States. And to have this chance to do this affirmative civil rights work is something that's been just incredibly successful, both for us and both for their offices. As far as filing complaints, it works both ways. Individuals can reach out to their U.S. Attorney's Office and send them a letter, or you can go – the easiest way, of course, is to go through our office. If it goes to directly to the U.S. Attorney's Office, that office is going to coordinate with us, and, you know, eventually that complaint will be logged and recorded with our office, and then we'll work with the U.S. Attorney's Office. So either way, if it comes in here – We'll assign it out to a U.S. Attorney's Office, whatever makes the most sense for a particular matter. And sometimes that depends on whether, you know, the allegation is against an entity that has a nationwide presence, whatever it might be. So whatever works best. But, yeah, all of our doors are open across the country.
Great. And then we had a question submitted online. I promise we'll get to our questions that were submitted in advance, but this ties into it. Someone wanted to know where they can see. Is there a location, a website where folks can see all of the Justice Department settlement agreements under ADA enforcement?
Absolutely. ADA.gov is one-stop shopping for everything, and you'll see there's an enforcement section. There's a law section, which is going to include the regs and the statute, and then there's technical assistance. And we have some specific pages on specific topics, if that's of interest, like a voting page, an Olmstead page, HIV page. So it's helpful, and you can once you get onto the enforcement pages, you can search by topic. So say you're interested in childcare, you can search childcare or daycare and find every settlement that we've done touching on that topic.
Great, thanks. All right, let's move into questions that were submitted in advance of today's session. And, of course, we were talking before the session started that it wouldn't be a Department of Justice audio conference session without a service animal question, and we have several of them. So let's start with this one, which is, can an individual have multiple service animals?
Good afternoon, Peter. It's Andy Washburn here. Just a quick correction. I'm not an attorney for the department. I know many fine people here that are attorneys, but I'm actually an accessibility specialist, and I primarily work on the ADA information line. And I can tell you that this question comes up with a great deal of frequency, both from the disability community and from covered entities, state, county, local government under Title II, and private businesses, commercial facilities covered by Title III. There is no language in the ADA statute or the Title II regulations or Title III regulations that limits the number of animals that a person with a disability could have as service animals. And there are a lot of legitimate examples where, for example, you might have a person that has mobility issues, difficulty walking or ambulating, and might use two dogs, one on each side, working in tandem to maintain balance, as an example. You could also see instances where a person might have multiple disabilities, and you would have a dog trained to perform one set of tasks for one disability. Let's say a person has a seizure condition, and the service animal might be trained to alert the individual when it senses a change in the body chemistry indicating that a seizure might be coming on. That dog might be very close to the individual, and you wouldn't necessarily want that dog, that animal, to be trained to do something apart from doing the seizure alert. So you might have a second animal that would be performing some other set of work or tasks that relate to a secondary disability that that person might have. Now, the corollary to this is that even though the ADA statute and the regulations don't limit the number of animals, that doesn't mean that a covered entity has to accept an unlimited number of animals or service animals because the person states that they are service animals. And an example of this would be within the last couple of weeks, I had a coworker on the ADA information line who got a call from a hotel. And the hotel indicated that they had a guest that was arriving and that that guest had 10 chihuahuas that they indicated were trained to assist her to get up if she fell. And this person wanted to know whether that could be legitimate and whether or not they had to accept 10 chihuahuas. And so quite separate and apart from whether or not it would be possible to train 10 chihuahuas to assist somebody to get up from a fall, I don't, when you look at the language in the Title II and the Title III regulations, the obligations of those covered entities are only to reasonably modify policies, practices, and procedures. And personally, I just don't think I could find a scenario where I think it would be reasonable for a hotel to accept 10 chihuahuas in one hotel room. It would be quite likely that that would be disruptive to other guests, and it might prove very difficult to keep the room clean, among other things. So although a person can certainly have more than one service animal, that doesn't mean that a covered entity has to accept some unlimited number of animals.
Great, great explanation, great answer on that, Andy. Thank you. And for those of you that have not seen or read the Justice Department Americans with Disabilities Act frequently asked questions on service animals, I would encourage you to do so. It covers a whole lot of scenarios and is more than obviously frequently asked questions, goes into depth and provides those scenarios that the Justice Department is getting questions on. So we'll stick with the service animal theme here, and this is a question that we get here at Great Lakes and over the National Network 800 line, and that involves local licensing and requirement that animals have appropriate vaccination shots. And the question being, can a local business, can a local government entity, play the part of enforcing that local requirement? And, while covered entities are limited to asking, the two questions, is it a service animal? What work or task has the animal been trained to do? Can they enforce local requirements regarding vaccination? Can they require that persons with disabilities, that their service animals have appropriate tags, licenses on?
Sure. So Andy Washburn again here, Peter. So this question again comes up with some frequency on the ADA information line, usually in a couple of contexts. We noticed, especially when we adopted our revised regulations in 2010, this seemed to generate a lot of calls, a lot of questions into the office about if I was a business, if I was a hospital or a medical facility, could I require that the person provide, say, vaccination records that indicated that the service animal had received its vaccinations. And essentially, our regulations are silent on that issue. I don't believe it would be a violation for a covered entity to ask a question about whether or not the dog is up to date on its vaccinations. I think it would prove more difficult to force somebody to provide proof. So if a person answered in the affirmative, that effectively should be enough at that point. They should not have to be forced to carry vaccination records with them at all times. Now, what is common in many jurisdictions, especially at the city or the county level, is that all dogs that reside in that county or that city may be required to have a tag, for example, that indicates that it's up to date on a rabies vaccination. And service animals would be as subject to that requirement as pets in that jurisdiction would be. However, I think our feeling is that an entity probably can't bar a service animal because it's not wearing its tag. It would strike me that that would be more likely a local jurisdiction matter, where if there was animal control that wanted to enforce the fact that the dog didn't have its tag, that might be appropriate. But I think our stance would be that is, if a person indicates that the dog is up to date on its rabies vaccination and it doesn't necessarily have the tag, that's probably not going to be enough for that Title II or Title III entity to prevent the service animal from coming into that environment.
Great, thanks. Thanks for that, Andy. Yeah, when we get that question, I always ask, who's responsible for enforcing the local requirements that dogs be licensed and have appropriate vaccinations, and it's typically not a business or it's typically done through the animal control as you mentioned. One additional question. I'm sure we'll get some others on service animals, and then I promise we'll move on. But it is a popular hot topic, and again, this is a question that we're getting frequently. I'm sure that you are, Andy, on the ADA hotline, and the issue of dirty service animals, unkempt, may appear to have fleas. We get the question oftentimes in the context of individuals with disabilities wanting to bring a service animal into a shelter. What does a covered entity, whether Title II or Title III, have in terms of admitting or not admitting a service animal that may be appear to be dirty or actually dirty or may have some other issues such as fleas or other concerns?
So, Andy Washburn here again. Peter, you're right. This is a question, again, that does come up frequently on the ADA information line. So I think there's multiple parts to this question. The first is that, when you look at the requirements in the Title II and the Title III regulations, there really are two reasons under which you could exclude a service animal. The first would be that the animal was not under the person's control, and secondly, if the animal was not housebroken. Now, of course, both Title II and Title III entities have other broader defenses, such as not having to, if there was a direct threat, meaning that it was something that couldn't be mitigated in some way. Issue here is that if the dog is simply dirty and we're not, actually visibly observing fleas, as an example, you're really speculating at that point that there's a direct threat. And to exclude, in that sort of an instance, you'd have to make sure that the threat was a non-speculative threat. Also, of course, a covered entity doesn't have to do something that would be considered to be a fundamental alteration to the nature and services that they would be providing. I think part of what this comes down to is sometimes you have to apply some degree of common sense. When somebody brings dog into an environment, the dog is probably going to smell a little bit because it's a dog. Now, I'm not saying that all dogs are filthy, but all dogs are going to have some smell. I think that there would be instances, exceedingly rare, but I would concede I think there could be instances where an animal could be so filthy that it might not be appropriate to allow that person into an environment. Or I think an example that came up on the information line had to do with public transportation, a fixed route bus as an example. So if you were telling me that a dog was so dirty that it was making people's eyes water and they were forced to get off a bus, well, that's not necessarily not being in control, and that's not necessarily the fact that the dog's not housebroken. But it seems to me that there would be an argument to be made that potentially there would be a direct threat there. Potentially you could argue a fundamental alteration. If the dog is just so unclean that it's disruptive to the way in which that business or government entity functions, it seems to me that there's likely to be an argument to be made under the regulations for potentially excluding that animal. Again, I think that would be exceedingly rare, but I think it's possible.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much, Andy. We had a question submitted online and on service animals and Title I, and a question about whether or not Title I has a definition of service animals. I will refer you back to last month's audio conference session in the archive, which was Ask the EEOC, and this question was addressed. But to the questioner, you are correct. The Title I, the employment provisions of the ADA, does not include a definition of service animals, and that would be handled as any other reasonable accommodation process. But you can find the archive of last month's session by visiting ada-audio.org. All right, let's take a break from our service animal questions and give Andy a chance to take a break and get a sip of water and look at some of the other questions that we had submitted in advance. And a question about obligations of a court to make modifications for a potential juror who is obese and may need modifications in order to serve as a juror. So what would be Title II court's obligations in terms of having to accommodate someone that is obese who may be a prospective juror?
So, Peter, I'm going to handle that one again. Andy, I promise I won't be handling all the questions. But in this instance, a very common question that we get on the information line is, is XYZ condition considered to be a disability? And there is no master list of all conditions, diseases, et cetera, that would necessarily be considered to be disabilities. The definition, which is a three-pronged definition of disability, is constructed to be broad and to bring into or under the umbrella of ADA's protection would include, one, an individual who has a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more major life activities. Two, a person could have a history of having had such a physical or mental impairment. And three, somebody could be regarded as having a disability, even if they don't actually have a disability, they might be treated like they do have one. And so in looking at it in that context, we're never going to say all people who are morbidly obese are people with disabilities. What we would probably analyze here would be, does the person have an underlying medical condition that perhaps morbid obesity, where the person, as a result of that underlying medical condition, may be morbidly obese, that underlying medical condition could be a disability. And in some instances, people who are morbidly obese might be treated like a person with a disability, even if they aren't. Although in that sense, if we regarded them, I think there wouldn't be an obligation to accommodate because they don't actually have a disability in that particular context. But if they did have a disability through the first prong of the definition of disability, then obviously the Title II entity might have to make reasonable modifications to policies, practices, and procedures, obviously could not deny an opportunity to participate based on disability. The question doesn't really identify what sorts of accommodations the person would want, but it is certainly possible that there could be an obligation to accommodate.
All right, great, Andy. And if you answer the next question, I'm going to do a roll call to make sure that I haven't all left you on your own there. So, okay, a couple questions that came in, and I'm sort of going to combine these to address the situation. So we had a question about, you know, rulemaking with regards to accessible technology. So if you could provide an update on where that stands for both, you know, for the titles of the ADA. And then a second question that came in regarding access to information that is on websites that may not be accessible, and obligations of, for instance, a local government entity regarding that information. So the two questions are, you know, one, can you provide us with an update on rulemaking for accessible technology? And then the second question I'll pose as, you know, in the absence of, you know, at this point, enforceable standards, what are the other obligations, regulatory obligations for Title II entities regarding information that's being provided on their websites?
Sure. So this is Stephanie. I'll take sort of the first part of that question about the regulations, and then I will call on Andy to help me talk about effective communication a little bit. The update that I have to provide is probably what folks already know. In December, the department announced a withdrawal of our Title II and Title III website accessibility rulemakings. And at this time, the department is reevaluating whether specific technical standards are necessary and appropriate. And, you know, we are doing that evaluation. But it is important to note that the withdrawal of these rulemakings does not change the substantive requirements of the ADA to provide effective communication and the requirement that websites be made accessible. Andy, do you want to talk a little bit about website accessibility and how a covered entity, you know, needs to provide effective communication?
Sure. So when you look at the Title II regulation, subpart E of that regulation requires that Title II entities ensure that their communications with people who have disabilities are as effective as they are with the general public. And the question, as it was posed to us, had to do with a government website and that there were information that was available on the website, but it wasn't downloadable, it wasn't something that you could print, we would clearly indicate that there would need to be auxiliary aids and services that would provide accessibility. Now, the city might make the website accessible, and even though we have not adopted specific standards for that, there are still ways to do that. There would also be other methods by which they could provide access to the information that's being provided to the public generally, and they would really have to give some preference to what it is, some primary consideration, some deference to what it is that the person who has the disability needs and the format in which that information would be provided. So that's an important concept that Title II entities have to think about when meeting the needs of people with disabilities in communications.
I agree that, and that's important to understand. I think Andy, that even without enforceable standards, there are still regulatory requirements that address the issues of access to information in general for both you know, Title II and Title III of the ADA. All right, if we can touch on, if you can provide some clarification, I don't know if this is a Stephanie area or a Katie area, regarding if you could provide us with an explanation on, I think it was back in December, the Attorney General announced the several guidance materials under the ADA had been rescinded. And if you could provide just an explanation of that, I think there was may have been some misunderstanding. And then, in addition, the questioner also wanted to know about one of those documents that was that was taken back was on Olmstead and the application of Olmstead in employment systems.
Sure. So this is Stephanie. So as people are probably aware, this administration and this president has implemented several executive orders that pertain to guidance and reviewing guidance documents and reducing the number of guidance documents that exist. And so as part of the ongoing government-wide efforts to reduce regulatory burdens and improve the quality of guidance documents, you know, we, as every other department, has been engaging in regulatory review. As part of this process, the department reviewed public input received through a request for comments that the department's Regulatory Reform Task Force put out, which was in June of 2017. And in response to that, there were quite a few comments that were received on the Olmstead document that you're referring to, which was a 2016 guidance document on state and local governments' employment service systems. And so one thing I would just pause to say is that, you know, the department does periodically put out requests for comments, and we would certainly encourage folks to look for those because your voices are important, and the department is responsive to folks' comments, or at least tries to be, and so we're always eager to receive public input. With the Olmstead document, the removal of the document was taken in order to afford further discussion with relevant stakeholders, including public entities and the disability community, as to how best to provide technical assistance in this area. And if you go to our website on our Olmstead section, you will see a statement that says what I just said, but it basically talks about the decision to remove the Olmstead document at this time. I will also note that the department will maintain a list of all documents that it has withdrawn. Those documents are on that list, and if there are any others that are taken down in the future, they will be put up on that list. You can also search on ada.gov using the word withdrawn, and those documents will come up. Something that I just want to note is that just like the withdrawal of the web rules, just because a document is withdrawn does not change the obligations that exist under the ADA. And so the Olmstead decision is still law. It's still binding Supreme Court law and, you know, other binding legal requirements. And so the withdrawal should also not be understood as expressing any views on the legal merits or the principles that were set forth in that statement, or on the merit of any specific procedures that are currently in place in any state or local jurisdictions. So we continue to plan to fully and fairly enforce the ADA. And that's what we have to say about that.
All right, great. Thanks, Stephanie. And like you said, there are a couple of Justice Department settlement agreements on that. And some of the other documents that were rescinded were based on the original 1991 ADA Justice Department regulations, or based on the 91 ADA accessibility standards. So speaking of accessibility standards.
Wait, hold on. I'm Peter.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry to interrupt. I was just going to mention for those who do get, if you look at the DOJ website now, you'll see that the division just entered into a new Olmstead agreement, I believe involving law enforcement, or I'm sorry, it may just be a very large systemic agreement involving the state of Louisiana and law enforcement. And I was looking, I just want to grab the press release so I can actually give you right. So the department reaches agreement to resolve ADA investigation of Louisiana's use of nursing facilities to serve people with serious mental illness. So this is a matter in which I believe the department filed a complaint in federal court and then resolved it with a settlement agreement with the state of Louisiana. So for those who are interested in the department's Olmstead work, I think you can go on and see the most recent and hot off the presses work in that area. All right, sorry, go ahead.
All right, that's great. So we've got, as you can see, that in continued enforcement, and you have settlement agreements out there, and that will be available on ADA.gov. All right. So going on to some accessibility questions that that we had submitted in advance, and question dealing with a mobile bathing facility that's provided at a shelter, and what would be the application of the ADA, and more specific, what would be the application of the 2010 ADA standards to, you know, a temporary movable bathing station that had, you know, three bathing facilities, within that mobile unit.
Hi, Peter. This is Mary. I'll take that one. So there wasn't when I was looking at the question, I actually looked up to see what our options were for these mobile hygiene centers. It appears that some are doing them in vehicles, in buses and vans. Some of them are doing them as trailers, so more portable, you know, portable bathing units. And so I'll kind of talk a little bit about both of those. Although the mobile hygiene center, if you have a van or a bus, is a facility subject to requirements of Title III and also of Title II, but I'll start with Title III. There are no specific standards for newly constructed or altered vans. So, but the vehicles are subject to other Title III requirements, including the obligation to provide equal opportunity and the duty to remove architectural communication if that's necessary in the situation, and transportation barriers to the extent that it's readily achievable to do so. And if it's not, then they'd have to provide alternative methods so that these surfaces were offered to everyone. In particular, so you could look to, in order to remove those barriers, you could look to the 2010 standards as a guidance for, you know, what it would take to have accessibility in those vans. As far as the ones that are trailers or probably would look more like portable units, those could follow the 2010 standards as portable units, and so we could look to that. I don't know if I have enough information to really specifically talk about this this particular trailer question. And under Title II, of course, you know, if the local, state, or government is running the shelter or providing these shower facilities, then there would be, you know, a program access obligation to make those showers and bathing areas accessible to people with disabilities.
Great, and I think that the important thing for folks to remember is that you know, temporary facilities, you know, structures are subject to, you know, the 2010 standards and to the ADA in general. So Mary is speaking about temporary. We also had a question about an entity that uses as an overflow parking, and we get these questions, and I'm sure Andy and you get these questions. It's summertime. We have lots of festivals and temporary events, and everyone's doing their rib fest and their music fest and all sorts of things. What is the application of the ADA to just in general, you know, temporary parking that's provided in grassy areas or, you know, on dirt areas?
I think if you're providing additional accessible parking, so then your numbers of parking spaces go up, then you would look to the chart and the standards to find out how many accessible spaces that would be needed. and provide those spaces to meet that increased quantity of parking spaces offered. Of course, they wouldn't meet the standards if they were, provided on the grassy areas, but you might be providing them, closer on an accessible surface.
Great, thanks. Another question here on the Access Board had published a final rule under the Architectural Barriers Act, ABA, regarding outdoor developed areas, so addressing areas such as picnic areas, campsites, beach sites, and a question about rulemaking for that under Title II of the ADA, and the questioner wanted to know, in the absence of, enforceable standards, what is, good guidance for state and local governments that do have, state parks, campsites, and picnic locations? What's their best options for, compliance and ensuring access for people with disabilities?
Sure, Peter. It's Andy again. As you stated, obviously, the standard that was adopted was under the Architectural Barriers Act. I think, having read the Access Board's website, I think they will be engaged in some in drafting some guidelines specifically for the ADA, which I know the department will have some input into. We frequently get questions where there may not be direct standards currently under the ADA as adopted by the department, but there may be other groups like the U.S. Access Board that has put out good material that is well-considered material and research material on how to make certain environments accessible. And it's not uncommon that in answering a question like that, that we would point to that information that's available and make it clear, although the ADA doesn't compel the covered entity to use that guidance, that it is information that they could point to from a very reliable source on how to make those environments, or at least those aspects of those environments for which we do not currently have standards, accessible to people with disabilities. So it's very common that we would refer people to that information and tell them that they might want to review it for how to make those elements accessible.
Thanks, Andy. And we also, on the topic of pending rulemaking, had a couple questions regarding public rights of way, which falls under the jurisdiction enforcement of the U.S. Department of Transportation. And just like the outdoor developed area rule, the Access Board does have draft guidelines for the public right-of-way. And when we talk about public right-of-way, we're talking about public sidewalks, street crossings, on-street parking, and the like. So, again, that's an area where a public entity could choose to use that. Those are the best guidelines available for, compliance and doing self-evaluation and transition plans. And in fact, the U.S. Department, the Federal Highway Administration, has sent out information, encouraging state and local government entities to use those draft public rights of way guidelines, because, as we know, the 2010 standards, that those are accessibility requirements, specifically for a site for a building. So hopefully that information is helpful for the folks that had questions about PROAG public rights of way accessibility guidelines.
Peter?
Yes.
Can we add, this is Mary. I'd like to add, as far as the public rights of way guidelines and the requirements under the ADA, the Section 35151I of the 2010 standards does have two requirements, or you would have to comply with the 2010 standards of related to curb ramps that are in the right of way. If you have newly constructed or altered streets, roads, or highways, they must contain curb ramps or sloped areas at any intersection having curbs or other barriers to entry from the street level pedestrian walkway, or and also when you have newly constructed or altered street level pedestrian walkways, they must contain curb ramps or other sloped areas to the. So if the street is altered, the curb ramps need to comply. If the walkway is altered and hits an intersection where there's a curb, that curb ramp needs to comply as well. And Section 406 of the 2010 standards has technical requirements for curb ramps. So they must follow the 2010 standards to comply with that obligation under Title II to provide access to programs, activities, and services that are accessible to and usable by individuals with disabilities. And also what we're saying, what we've said is that, you know, public entities may turn to different sources for guidance when determining how to comply, which is what you mentioned, with the program access requirement in the absence of standards. So in all other situations other than these two curb ramp locations, but a public entity could look to the 2010 standards, as some of those standards include requirements that might be analogous to issues in the public right-of-way. And then, as you stated, they could also look, they may wish to consider the 2011 Access Board draft guidelines. We just want to make sure that they understand that the proposed guidelines that the Access Board has have not been finalized or adopted by DOJ or DOT, so they're not enforceable or otherwise required. So I just want to make that clear that there are two situations that are covered by the 2010 standards.
Right, right. And the Justice Department has a really good technical assistance document that was issued in conjunction with the Department of Transportation on resurfacing and obligations to address the lack of curb ramps at intersections.
That's correct. And also defines what is considered an alteration in the public right-of-way.
Right, which, yeah, yes, is a question and gives very specific examples. So that another document, the technical assistance document that you can find on ADA.gov, when you get to the homepage, look for the link that says, I believe it's requirements and technical assistance materials is the link. Alrighty, let's go on to another question here that was submitted in advance, and a question about taxis and the requirement to provide accessible vehicles by taxi companies, accessible minivans, and then also a question about the application of the ADA to the newer, I guess they've been around for a bit now, but for the rideshare services such as Uber and Lyft, and the application of the ADA to those types of services.
This is Stephanie. So the transportation regulations are actually issued by DOT under their authority under Title II, Subtitle B of the ADA. So we have sort of concurrent jurisdiction with DOT on a lot of transportation issues, but those regulations, as opposed to finding them in the same section where you'll find most of our regulations, you'll actually find them at, I believe it's 49 CFR 37. And so taxis the DOT regulations have some vehicle accessibility requirements, but taxis are not covered under those vehicle accessibility requirements. In other words, making the actual vehicles themselves accessible. And so the DOT regulations and we also are silent on modifying minivan type of vehicles currently. So I can't provide any great advice on that, but I can talk a little bit about Uber and Lyft and our position on those services. So actually in 2014, the DOJ weighed in with a statement of interest in a case called National Federation of the Blind versus Uber, which was in the Northern District of California. And in that case, an individual who had a service animal was denied access to an Uber, and the question was sort of whether or not these services were considered to be public accommodations. And the answer to that question was it doesn't really matter whether they're public accommodations or not, because they are actually covered separately under the Department of Transportation regulations as what's called a demand-responsive transportation service. So just like taxis, the vehicle itself is not required to be accessible, but they do have to meet all of the sort of program access requirements, which does include allowing service animals in the vehicle. So it is it's a long way of saying that our response to that is that Uber and Lyft and all these other rideshare apps that are sort of popping up these days do need to meet accessibility requirements, specifically allowing service animals.
All right. Great. Thanks. You had a question regarding ticketing and the use of the accessible seating location. And the question had to do with an individual that uses a service animal that is using the accessible seating location and whether or not there would be a requirement of the individual with the disability to keep the service animal within the wheelchair seating location.
So this is Andy again, Peter. There's no language in our regulations that specifies that the dog must be kept specifically within the boundaries of that space. Clearly, the individual who's using the service animal needs to maintain control over the animal, and the animal can't be disruptive to other individuals who are at the event and enjoying whatever event it might be, whether it's musical, a theatrical, or a sporting event or whatever. We don't categorically say that not even so much as a tail wagging outside of the space would be some violation of the law. I think in most instances, the dog is probably going to be of a size that could be contained within the space, but we don't specifically state that. And I don't think we would see it as a violation if the dog was somewhat out of the space, but not, again, actively interfering with somebody else's enjoyment of the event. That makes sense?
Great. Thanks, Andy. Yes, that does. And another sort of a service animal question, but it has other aspects to it. So this questioner wanted to know about a college that is renting out dormitory rooms during the summer, operating it as sort of, you know, transient lodging, and wanted to know what are the, you know, the requirements for the college in that context. And then there's an additional part of the question that indicates that the college is requiring individuals that use or have service animals to go through an additional step in order to get approval to be allowed to have the service animal accompany the person with a disability. So a question about, you know, the application of the ADA to this type of situation, and then the individual, you know, wanted to know what options they have in terms of, you know, exercising, protecting their rights.
So this is Andy again. So from the question, we don't know whether the school is a Title II or a Title III entity, which will change what kinds of obligations an existing facility is likely to have. In this case, with regard to the current standards, we would reference this as transient lodging, and so there would be specific requirements for mobility rooms, rooms that have features for people with mobility disabilities, as well as a certain number of apartments or rooms that are being rented that would meet the needs of people who have communications issues. If we're talking about a Title II entity, state, county, local government, they're going to have a rather broad program access requirement. And so we might not specify a specific number of rooms because it's not new construction. They do have to make their programs accessible. And so they are going to have to take a look at probably upgrading some of those elements to ensure that, you know, at least one, if not more, of the rooms meet requirements for mobility features, as well as one, if not more, rooms, units that would have features for people with communication needs. if this was a private entity, not run by a religious entity, then they would likely have obligations to remove barriers that are readily achievable. And that's a requirement that's going to require significantly less accessibility than a program access requirement would be. And that's going to be more about, you know, can we remove certain barriers that are easily accomplishable without much difficulty or expense? And much of that's going to be determined by what it would cost to remove certain barriers, what the resources of the Title III entity are, whether there are some inherent architectural limitations that would prevent full compliance. So there's going to be obligations, but it's probably going to fall short of a new construction standard.
All right, great. Thanks, Andy. And staying along the lines of barrier removal, a question that was submitted, and the question about, you know, grandfather clause, and does the ADA apply to, you know, all buildings, all facilities, regardless of when, you know, when those facilities were constructed, and if you could, you know, address that issue. You started to talk about, you know, barrier removal obligations. If you could just talk about, you know, that phrase that we sometimes hear, you know, grandfather clause.
Yeah, that comes up all the time, Peter. Frequently, well, let me put it this way. I think for most businesses, it's intuitive for them, if they're building something brand new, that they have to make it accessible. Even if they don't know what the standards are, I think they get that it has to be accessible. And when they're altering, again, most businesses are going to understand, I'm altering this, I'm going to have to, you know, provide some accessibility here. And they may not know what that means, but I think they get that. What's less intuitive, from my experience in talking with many businesses, is that if they've done nothing to the property, it was built 60 years ago, and they haven't done anything at all for the last 35 years, no alterations, no new construction, they don't understand that they may well have an affirmative obligation to remove barriers that are readily achievable. Again, that's going to fall usually short of a new construction standard, but many times people with disabilities will find that they can use the facility with just nominal changes that provide a bit more accessibility than it was. And we clearly want to get people into facilities, and we want to get people to where services are being provided for the general public. And then we would start to look at other ancillary things like services or elements that might support the primary area where the public's getting service, like a bathroom or a water fountain, those kinds of things. And so there is an ongoing obligation that Title III entities have to remove barriers that are readily achievable, again, as defined, easily accomplishable, and easily accomplishable and able to be carried out without much difficulty or expense. It's an ongoing obligation. And again, I think that's just not intuitive. It's not a particularly well understood part of the law, but those entities are not going to be grandfathered, i.e., as in not having any responsibility to do anything.
Great. Thanks, Andy. And another really good technical assistance document primer for small business, you know, takes you through the steps, gives you examples, and it, as well as, you know, other parts of Title III, but does take you through the priorities for barrier removal, giving really good examples. So you can, again, find that on the Justice Department ADA.gov website. The question, and this is something that pops up from time to time, the question of the new symbol of accessibility, which is sometimes described as the, you know, the dynamic symbol of accessibility, and a question about, you know, in the Justice Department 2010 standards, there is a section that allows what is called equivalent facilitation, which allows a departure from the specific technical requirements where one is providing, you know, equal or greater access. So this questioner wants to know about the application of that, you know, equivalent facilitation to this new dynamic symbol of accessibility, for instance, being used on accessible parking spaces and other areas.
So let me share two thoughts about that with you, Peter. The first, as you've referenced, is, you know, when you look at our 2010 standards, Chapter 1, Section 103, does provide for this ability of an entity to depart from our standards when they can show that what they're doing provides substantially equivalent or greater accessibility. That would be the equivalent facilitation part. There's also an advisory there that makes it quite clear that it is the covered entity's responsibility to show that it is an equivalent facilitation. So the burden of proof is theirs to show that what they've done is an equivalent facilitation. But the second part I'd like to share with you comes from a phone call I took from the owner of a Title III entity. This was a few weeks back, who had questions about this new dynamic symbol and really wanted to get a sense of whether or not it would be an equivalent facilitation or not. And they were revamping their facility, and he was going to be putting this, or wanted to put it, at the accessible parking spaces. They also had multiple entrances to a building, and not all the entrances were accessible, so he wanted to mark the accessible entrances. They also had public restrooms. Again, they were not all accessible public restrooms, so he wanted to mark or designate the accessible public restrooms with this symbol of accessibility. So in thinking about this issue with him and talking with him, you know, I made the point that when you put up the international symbol of accessibility, that is usually conveying very specific information about the ways in which certain elements are going to be accessible. So if you put that at a parking space, you know, for many people with disabilities, that's going to mean that the space is a certain width, that there's going to be an access aisle, that there's going to be some sort of route, accessible route that gets them to where they're going from the parking. If you're putting it at the entrance of a facility, then you're going to have a sense that the entrance or the route there is going to be so wide that it's, you know, that the slope is going to be a certain thing if it's just a route, or another thing if it's a ramp. But that information is going to be conveyed. If it's on a bathroom, you're going to have a sense that the lavatory is going to be a certain height, that the controls are going to be a certain place, and I'm going to be able to operate those controls with one hand, that the toilet is likely to be in a corner. It's going to be so high. There's going to be grab bars at the back and on the side walls. And so in talking about that with this gentleman, I said, you know, if somebody is driving into a parking space and it has this new dynamic symbol, there's a lot of visual cues that go along with the sign. They're going to see that the space is wide enough. They're going to see that there's an access aisle there. They're going to see that, or probably going to see that there's a route that leads them to where it is that they want to go from the parking. And so I think that's going to be fairly intuitive to many people in that context. But if you put the new dynamic symbol on a bathroom, for example, I don't know what's in that bathroom until I go in. You're not going to get the same sort of visual cues. You may not be conveying the same information as you would a parking stall where you can see everything. So I think there's a danger of just sort of assuming that the new symbol is absolutely an equivalent facilitation. I think you have to take a look at the context and determine, you know, whether that would be appropriate. But I certainly think in some instances it will be intuitive. It may be less intuitive in other environments.
Thanks, Andy. And you know, always the, you know, the obligation you know, is on the entity to prove equivalent facilitation if ever challenged. A question regarding one of the exception allowances in the 2010 standards. So in Chapter 213 of the 2010 standards, there is an exception for single-user toilet rooms, and the exception is that no more than 50% of those rooms are required to be accessible. And this questioner wants to know, does that exception or will that exception apply to single-user bathing rooms?
Hi, Peter. This is Mary. I'll take that one. If you look at 213.2, the second part of that that section says where bathing rooms are provided, each bathing room shall comply with 603. So we'll start there, and then we want to look down that exception list to see if that requirement's changed. And when you look at exception 4, it is very specific to say toilet rooms. It does not say bathing rooms. So that would mean that all of the bathing rooms would have to comply. There wouldn't be an exception to only providing 50% that comply.
All right. Great. Thanks for that clarification, Mary. To our other Mary, our operator, at this point I'm going to check with you real quick to see if we have any questions on the telephone.
At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster.
Okay. Well, we're doing that, and I'll come back to you, Mary, if we have time, since there's no one on there now. A question regarding the use of LULAs, and I don't know if this is a Mary question or an Andy question, but the limited use, limited access elevators, and questioner wanting to know whether or not those are can be used under the 2010 standards, the use of the LULA or limited use, limited access elevators.
Right, so that would be Mary again. Thank you. So the LULA can be used when an elevator is not required, so it can't replace an elevator that's required by the standards. It can be used if you're a facility that falls under some of the elevator exceptions, you're less than 3 stories or less than 3,000 square feet per floor, you're not required to put an elevator, to put an accessible route to a level, but you choose to put in a LULA to a level, you could do that. The other place you could use a LULA is any place that's permitted under 206.7 to use a platform lift. So it could be used instead of a platform lift in those specific instances, and they're listed in 206.7.
All right, great. We'll stick with the another 2010 standard question, an elevator question. And the question has to do with buildings that either are required to provide elevators because they're, you know, more than 3 stories or more than 3,000 square feet, or where they choose to provide an elevator. And, you know, the requirement when you have a building that has a mezzanine within one of those stories, and what are the 2010 requirements regarding access to those mezzanines in buildings that do have elevators within them?
Right. So what was interesting about this question is going back to kind of the beginning, and where the 91 standard spoke about elevators, the 2010 standards talks about accessible routes, and so an elevator is one element that could be used in an accessible route. The exception falls for a facility that has less than 3 stories. So if we hit the 3-story mark, we now have to have accessible routes to all the stories and mezzanines. So the overall requirement is to have the accessible route go to all stories and all mezzanines that don't fall under those exceptions. Once you fall under that exception, so you're less than 3 stories in this case, or less than 3,000 feet, then you look. So the exception says that you do not have to provide an accessible route to the stories, and so the questioner kind of got that correct in that it doesn't say mezzanines; it just says stories, where the beginning of that section 206.2.3 says you have to provide a route to all stories and mezzanines. This one takes out the requirement to provide an accessible route to stories. So then the question is, what happens to the mezzanines? So they're still required to be accessible under that situation because you had the requirement that said stories and mezzanines had to be accessible. And I think that that's the case because then when you get to other sections under the accessible route, so in 206.2, which is accessible route, let's see, what is it specifically called? I put it in here. Yeah, accessible routes were required. If you get to 206.2.4, which talks about spaces and elements, and it says at least one accessible route shall connect the accessible building and facility entrances with all accessible spaces and elements within the facility that are otherwise connected by a circulation path. And then it says, except if you meet one of those exceptions. So, okay, so we don't have to provide the accessible route because we met the exception to stories, but then what happens to the mezzanine? Well, interesting, if you look at exception 3 under that spaces and elements section, it tells you accessible routes are shall not be required to connect mezzanines where buildings and facilities have no more than one story, or in addition, where they're not required to connect stories, you know, if they're accepted. So that's kind of where it takes it out. And I think the reason the mezzanines are kind of parceled is because if you get to 206.2.5 as an example, restaurants and cafeterias, that requires an accessible route to all dining levels, whether they be raised or sunken or outdoor. And there's an exception under that requirement that says they're not, buildings and facilities are not required to provide an accessible route between stories. If it's not required to provide a route between stories, it's not required to provide a route to the mezzanine dining area, but there's a qualifier, where the mezzanine contains less than 25% of the total combined area for seating and dining, and the same decor and services are provided on an accessible level. So in that, for specifically for restaurants and cafeterias, you might have to provide an accessible route to a mezzanine. So I think you have to look at each kind of element, find out where you fall to see if that requirement to provide an accessible route to a mezzanine has been taken out by exception.
Excellent. Thanks for that that breakdown and explanation, Mary. We're getting close to the bottom of the hour here. A question that was submitted online regarding obligations of large box stores, such as hardware stores that provide for rental trucks, you know, your U-Haul type trucks to bring home, you know, the large merchandise that one has just purchased, or drywall, or what the case may be. And what are the obligations for those businesses with regards to providing hand controls for someone that requires hand controls to operate a vehicle?
Hmm. Well, you might have come up with one that stumped us all. I think, would that be in DOT's regs? Or?
No, it's probably a reasonable modification analysis. Is it a reasonable modification to require hand controls in that instance? Interestingly, in the Title III regulations, the installation of hand controls is one of the examples listed among the examples of generally readily achievable barrier removal. So this issue comes up. Sometimes I haven't seen it in this context, but I've seen it, you know, in others, and I think it's a fairly fact-specific analysis as to whether it would be a reasonable modification to do so, or whether it would be a fundamental alteration in terms of, you know, the safety specs or permanent changes to the car, to the van. I might depend on how large their fleet is. In general, I would think that the store would have an obligation to provide equal access. We've seen it in the rental car context, and we have taken the position that that rental car enterprises do have to provide hand controls. So I think generally it's an equal opportunity standard, and it very well might be required unless there were defenses. Interestingly, there's been some recent litigation on this issue where I believe there were thousands of pages of amicus briefs filed by not on the box stores, but on, I believe, used cars, and whether they need to install hand controls for so you could go on a test drive. And those amicus briefs raise, I think, really interesting factual questions about the actual what is involved in installing hand controls, what kind of training you have to do it, liability issues, safety issues, and things like that. So if anyone's really interested in this issue, I would recommend that you do a quick case law search, and I think there's some interesting issues there.
Thank you very much, and we've actually gone past the bottom of the hour, so I appreciate the extra time that you put in, all of you, Andy, Stephanie, Katie, and Mary, with answering these questions. We still had many questions that we were not able to get to, so you can certainly reach out to the Justice Department, the ADA hotline, as well as your regional ADA centers with additional questions, or if your question was not addressed, you can take those up. As a reminder, today's session has been recorded. A edited transcript of today's session will be available within 2 weeks' time and posted to the ADA Audio Conference website. I want to again thank our speakers today for their preparation, for their time in joining us today. The ADA National Network has a long history and relationship with the Department of Justice, and we at the National Network truly appreciate the ability to access all of you and your expertise and helping people understand rights and responsibilities under the ADA. We will be having information will be upcoming, forthcoming, regarding the July ADA Audio Conference series. Please stay tuned to ada-audio.org, and that is where you will find information about that session and the availability to register once that session has been posted. Again, thanks to our speakers. Thanks to all of you for participating. Thanks for all the questions submitted in advance and during the session. Hope to have all of you back in July. Thanks for joining us today. Take care and have a good day.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.